Hello and welcome to the Conduit podcast. I'm Rosie Fletcher, the editorial manager at the Conduit, a collaborative community dedicated to building a just, prosperous and sustainable future. Last Thursday, a few hours after Boris Johnson's resignation, we hosted the former Secretary of State for Health, Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy is chair of the Health and Social Care Select Committee and the author of a new manifesto for renewing the NHS, learning from mistakes and preventing avoidable deaths. It's called Zero and it's out now. Jeremy joined Hannah McInnes here at The Conduit to tell us more. The event was held in partnership with the How To Academy, London's home of big thinking. Listeners can also find the How To Academy podcast on all major podcasting platforms. Go and check them out for so many more inspiring conversations.
I'm delighted to welcome you on behalf of the Conduit Club and the How To Academy. And may I congratulate them on uncanny coinciding of this event with perhaps the most historical day in politics for a very long time. But we are not here to talk just about that, or it is all connected. It's all connected, it's all politics, but we're here to talk about something that is enormously important to most, if not all, of our lives, which is, of course, the NHS. And that's what the book that the event is inspired by is based on, Zero, Eliminating Unnecessary Deaths in a Post-Pandemic NHS, which is full of quite a few heartbreaking accounts, a number of failures and care failures, but also ways to deal with that, how we can get through it, which is perhaps the most important part. I'm sure you all know our guest this evening. He is the author of the book. He is, as we were just told, the longest serving health secretary from 2012 to 2018, the MP for Surrey West, and of course now he sits on the Health and Social Affairs Select Committee. Thank you so much indeed for being here, Jeremy. I'm quite amazed, actually, that you are.
Thank you.
Only just today's been quite a day. How's it been for you?
It's been just another day in British politics, of course. And, it's one of those days where if you're not standing for the leadership of the Conservative Party, you're very much in a very small minority amongst Conservative MPs. So... it's a day when everyone is, what's the word that's used in Westminster, taking soundings. We're going to talk about the NHS, but let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is the big news today. I think it is very important that today happened because there was a breach of trust between government and people, and we need to restore that. And what has been striking for me over the last couple of months is how many left-wing friends who do not support the Conservatives, who might have wanted to say, please keep Boris Johnson because that will give us a better chance of a Labour government, say, no, it has to change because it's our country. There's another 2 years for an election and we now have to rebuild that trust. And that's going to be a very big and difficult challenge. And I think that of political leaders with whom many people will disagree with what they stood for and what they did. You think of Margaret Thatcher and the big changes in the 1980s. You think of David Cameron and George Osborne with austerity. You can think of those changes, but you can think of Theresa May and some of the decisions over Brexit. You never doubted the integrity or sincerity of the Prime Minister in that. And rightly or wrongly, and I don't think we want to go into those, I think people did have those question marks and they had to be resolved. And so that's why I think today is an important change for the country.
You sort of addressed the elephant in the room, but not quite, because I think everybody obviously wants to know whether you still intend to put your hat in the ring. You said pretty much only us in this room or all Conservative MPs do, so I'm assuming that's yes.
I think it's no... It's no secret that I'm minded to be where I think the majority of Conservative MPs will probably be. I'm afraid this is not the occasion that I'm going to officially give you the answer to that. And I do want to talk to my colleagues, and things change, and I, so lots of those things are happening. The answer is that, you know, it's not a secret that I am seriously considering the possibility of joining 350 Conservative MPs in that contest.
Just one more thing on that, which is just there is a sense of confusion. You talk in the book, so about the book, about the experience you have of the well-oiled choreography of British government reshuffles. We are so far from that, and none of us really understand what's going on. Is he going to stay until he says he will?
Well, we have a Prime Minister who specialises in breaking the rules that have been around for a long time, and that's what I think has created some of the uncertainty. But there is now a very clear process, and you know, the MPs, Conservative MPs, whittle it down to two people. That can happen. Last time it took 3 weeks from this moment for that to happen. I think this time it's entirely possible it'll happen in 2 weeks because Parliament breaks for summer recess in 2 weeks. The members' stage, when Conservative Party members vote on the final two, last time it took 5 weeks. But then the time before, when Theresa May became Prime Minister, that didn't happen at all because the person who came second decided to fold in behind the person who came top. So these things can happen pretty quickly.
You do write about leadership in the book with reference to what you learnt about leaders through working with the NHS, and you say rather than force of nature types who bend people to their will, the more effective leaders tend to be more modest, big ears, big eyes and small mouth. Does that work in politics too?
Not always, but it was really interesting. So one of the things that I did, and you can't write a book like this about the future of the NHS without being honest about the things you got wrong, and I will do that, although it's a subjective book, so, you know, it was going to come from my point of view. But if you ask me the sort of one of the two or three things I was most proud of, one of them was that I introduced the Ofsted rating system that we have for schools, for hospitals. We'd never had that before because we had mid-staffs. And I said, how do we know if there's another mid-staffs around the corner? And they said, we don't. And I said, well, we've got to have a way of doing that. And so after a lot of debate, we have become the only health system in the world which rates every hospital outstanding, good, requires improvement, poor. I like the Ofsted system. I think it's good for parents. It's good for schools, although they curse it. But everyone knows where they stand. When we introduced that system, one of the great surprises, and I'm delighted we've got a very distinguished former Health Secretary, Virginia Bottomley, at the back, and she, I think, would probably say the same thing, that we found that the hospitals that got outstanding were led by rather quiet people. And there were the chief executives who were the kind of, I'm trying to find an appropriate way of describing people with big egos, but, for a family audience, but, boisterous. There were the people that thrust themselves forward, and they weren't actually running the best hospitals. And then I read a book by Jim Collins called Good to Great, which tried to look at what is the difference between good organisations and great organisations. And he was looking at American companies listed on the New York stock market. And he said the reason is because modest people attract great teams, because people who are really capable, they like working for a boss who's going to listen to them and let them shine, whereas the big sort of Jack Welch-style CEOs tend to attract yes-men. And so you end up with a very hollow management team. And I think exactly the same is true in hospitals.
You perhaps might explain to people who haven't read it the title, really, Zero, and why you chose to call it that.
Yes. I mean, first of all, this is a very unusual book to write, particularly for a Conservative Health Secretary, because you might think you'd be on an absolute hiding for nothing for someone who was a health secretary, at times a controversial health secretary, to write a book in which every single chapter starts with a horror story of something that's gone very badly wrong in the NHS. I then do say, why is this happening and what I think the solution is. The reason I started on this journey was because a few months in, I was, you arrive as health secretary, I knew nothing. I mean, Virginia, well, I won't say that Virginia knew nothing when she became health secretary, but I think most health secretaries are pretty terrified when you take on the fifth largest organisation in the world, 1.4 million employees, the largest employer in Europe, and you're surrounded by doctors who've been doing this for their lives, and you're a politician, and they really don't trust you. And the head of the chief executive of the NHS, who I had a lot of respect for, I grew to have a lot of respect for, he said, Jeremy, you've got to understand that in healthcare, we harm 10% of patients. In other words, we make mistakes that damage and kill people for 10% of patients. And by the way, that's not a UK figure. That's an internationally accepted figure in healthcare systems. So I thought, that's a bit of a surprise. And then I said, well, how many people actually die? And being the good old NHS, we have more statistics about our health service than anywhere else. We've actually got academic surveys. There's a survey by Hogan and Black, who work at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And they have measured, and they say that 4% of hospital deaths have a 50% chance or more of being preventable, which works out at about 150 preventable deaths a week. And the problem is that, you know, an average-sized hospital, that's like 50 deaths a month. Sorry, this is a really grim topic for a lovely summer's evening, but 50 deaths a month, because half of us die in hospital. The mortuary is pretty busy. Now, one or two of those deaths could have been prevented, but which one or two? No one wants to spend all their time going through all those things when they've got lots of patients who are alive who are waiting to be seen. So we end up kind of accepting it. And so the reason I call the book Zero is because I asked, should we not have the aim of having zero preventable deaths? And then I ask, because everyone said this is the cost of doing business. And then I looked at other industries, and the airline industry is the best industry that has changed its culture. And they used to have a culture, believe it or not, in the 1970s, which also said that it's inevitable we're going to have a few crashes every year. And they decided that they wouldn't have a business if they didn't do something about that. And they basically moved to a no blame. They used to fire pilots who made mistakes. We still fire doctors who make mistakes. And they said, we can't do that, because if we do that, they'll cover up the mistakes and we won't be able to learn from them. Now, the airline industry got the number, and so, and in since the 1970s, the number of deaths has gone down by 2/3, and the number of people flying has increased by 9 times. So it's become massively safer to fly as a result of those changes. And amazingly, in 2017, they got down to zero passenger deaths across the whole world in the airline industry. So they got to zero. Unfortunately, then we had the Boeing MAX jet crashes and it went up. So you can never be complacent. But I put that title in there as a kind of challenge. Sorry, it's a very long answer.
I mean, you ended on a positive note, I was going to say, on the balmy evening. But there is a positive... what underlies the book is positive, because you're saying that this should be a 1948 moment. I'm wary you wrote it before cost of living crisis that we're in now, perhaps the war in Ukraine, and we're in a really difficult place. Do you still have that optimism that we can seize a 1948 moment, as you call it?
I'll be honest. I am really worried that our NHS agenda is just falling back on a discussion about money. And I do talk about money in the book, and the NHS and the care system need more money, and they're going to carry on needing more money because we're living for longer and new medicines are coming on stream. But we also need to think of reforms. And so the 1948 was the year the NHS was founded. It's an incredible moment. It was a Labour government that did it. It was a big leap of faith, but it was also period when we were completely bankrupt in this country after the Second World War. And, you know, we were in a very challenging set of circumstances, and yet we found the imagination. And that's what I would like us to do with the NHS. I don't think it's enough to say, you know, 50,000 more nurses, 40 new hospitals, and, you know, a health and care levy, and that's it, ticking the NHS box. All those things will help, but there needs to be a lot more. And I'll give you one very good example. We spend roughly the same proportion of our GDP on health as France or Germany, But France has 20% more doctors per head. Germany has 60% more doctors per head, which is why you wait longer to see a doctor in this country. And why is that? It's because we spend £6 billion every year on locum doctors and agency nurses at huge expense, rather than training enough doctors in the first place.
So just before we come back to some of those, because essentially you do go through the various things that are going wrong and then the various ways in which we can change it. But I wonder if you could explain to people about your letters, which really form the backbone of the narrative and the many, as you called them, horror stories that we hear.
Well, I went on this journey in a very unusual way, because about, 5 months after I became health secretary, and I suppose I was kind of looking for a cause. I was thinking, can't change everything. What's the big thing I'm going to try and change? Which turned out to be patient safety. And I went to Margaret Thatcher's funeral, and it was, nothing to do with the NHS. It was a most extraordinary occasion. I felt, as we sang I Vow to Thee, My Country, I thought this is probably the most British moment you could ever imagine. And the Bishop of London gave the eulogy, and in his eulogy, he read out a letter that Margaret Thatcher had written as Prime Minister to an 11-year-old boy, which was amusing. And I listened to that, and I thought, in my 5 months as Health Secretary, I have not seen a single letter from a member of the public, not one. So I went back, and I asked my officials, who were brilliant people. They said, yes, well, we get more letters than anywhere else except number 10 Downing Street in this department. We have a team of 150 people whose job it is to reply to them so that you don't have to, Secretary of State. And I said, well, that's great, but I think I would like to... I'd like you to choose one a day that I can see and personally reply to, and I'll make that the first thing I do every day, just so that I'm a little bit in touch with what's going on. And nothing happened. And I discovered that there'd been meetings set up behind the scenes as to how can we dissuade the Secretary of State from this terrible idea. And then, so I chased, and then I got a letter came up and said, dear Secretary of State, we're just writing to say what wonderful service I have from the NHS. And I said, no, I want to know the problems. And then a really awful letter came about a dad whose daughter killed herself. And I wrote, I'm sorry. And it was the day after the daughter had been seen by a mental health nurse who hadn't spotted the risk. So I wrote, I'm truly sorry. And the letter came back saying, I'm sorry, Secretary of State, you can't say sorry. And I actually, for some reason, I knew my law on that, and I must have encountered it in another government job, that in our law, it's not an admission of liability to say sorry. So you can say sorry. And the letter stood. And I started seeing these letters, and they sort of framed my day. And they were all awful in different ways. One of them... a man went in to see his father who had dementia, and he was lying in a public ward naked on top of his bed with a catheter attached to his private parts, and the son complained and was brushed off by a nurse. So he wrote to the chief executive to complain, and the chief executive didn't reply personally. It was just PP'd by the chief executive's assistant. And so I wrote an apology letter. And 2 hours later, I had a meeting, and I thought, the name of that hospital looks familiar. And I realised it was the very same hospital, and they'd come to ask me for some capital funding, the chief executive. And I said, while you're here... And I have to say, that chief executive had the worst meeting of his entire life. And to his credit, he did go round to the house of the person and apologise personally, but... Anyway, that was my kind of way in as a non-doctor to trying to understand some of the problems we are facing.
So you can say sorry as a politician, I also take from that. Just because I'm wondering if, we didn't hear that word today, I don't think. But I might have missed it. Importantly, you did listen to those people, and they sat face to face with you. And there are so many stories in the book that are, as I said and you said, very heartbreaking. And you say, as Health Secretary, you're several layers away from what is happening, but ultimately you are responsible for everything that happens on your watch. That must be very difficult, and how you sort of distance yourself from not going home with a great amount of guilt every evening.
Yes, and so I think the first thing people say is, well, look, why didn't you sort out all these problems that you're writing about?
You include three tweets to explain.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, people are quite witty on Twitter sometimes. Sometimes they're horrible. But, you know, a very typical tweet I would get to some of these stories is, gosh, Jeremy Hunt's going to be really angry when he finds out who was Health Secretary for 6 years during all the time these problems happen. And, you know, so... And the truth is that I did make a start. By the end of my time, 3 million more patients were using good or outstanding hospitals than when I started, and the NHS was much more open. And I think the NHS today really is... There was a culture before. It's not, you know, just me that's changed. Lots of ethical doctors and nurses and managers really felt the time was right to change this culture. Sir Robert Francis said we had to change it in his report. But the NHS is really good now compared to how it was at being open when things go wrong. But the truth is that there were lots of things that I wish I had done, which I didn't do. And so let's just give you those. You know, I did increase the number of medical schools, 6 new medical schools, increase the number of doctors we train, but I wish I'd actually taken the decision about how many doctors and nurses we train out of the Westminster cycle and given it to a kind of independent body to decide. And the reason for that is it takes 10 years to train a consultant or a GP. And so when a health secretary and a chancellor are negotiating a spending round, it's never a priority for either of them how many doctors we're going to have in 10 years' time. They're not necessarily expecting to be doing that job then. And it costs £250,000 to train one doctor. So it's quite a lot of money. And the result is that we have a sort of market failure. We just continually don't train enough. And I think we need to find a way of knowing that whoever the health secretary is, whoever the chancellor is, whatever colour the party is, we are always training enough doctors and nurses for the future. I wish I'd done that. And the second thing I'll say that I wish I'd done is I wish I'd properly got us back to the system we had pre-2004, where GPs had individual patient lists and everyone had their own GP rather than being attached to a surgery. The contract changes that were made then were well-intentioned, but we know from evidence produced in Norway last year that if you see the same doctor over a long period of time, you're 30% less likely to go to hospital and 25% less likely to die. Because if you've got a funny cough, a doctor who knows you is more likely to say, I'm worried about that, let's go and check it's not lung cancer or whatever. And I did try and change it back. I didn't succeed. And if there's one thing that would make a real difference to the safety of care in the NHS, it would be that.
The continuity point, which you talk about in the book, how do we address that? Because, as you say, it's a hugely important issue, not just with GPs, but also into hospitals. The continuity, the information that they have about each patient, and they have to, so often families, as you say, keep re-giving the information and things get lost along the way, and it's a real waste of...
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, the frustration that, you know, people have is having to give the same information over and over again to a different team. But in the book, there's a story about a terrible story about a man who ultimately died because he had terrible diarrhoea and it wasn't fixed for 10 months. And the reason it wasn't fixed was because individual doctor after individual doctor said, I think it might be this, I'm going to refer you to an appointment. And then he waits a month or two for the appointment. Then another doctor says, no, it's not this, I'm going to refer you to another appointment. Anyway, it basically took 11 months before he had an operation on his bowels, and by which time it was too late. And that wouldn't have happened if there'd been one doctor who said, I'm in charge of you and I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And so it does matter. But there's something else that is a structural change. Now, I inherited some very big structural changes from Andrew Lansley, which were not very popular. And so I was very cautious about making any more changes. But I think we have gone mad about targets in the NHS. We have more targets than any other health system in the world. And I'm not against having one or two targets for a big objective, you know, bringing down the COVID backlog or something like that. But a hospital manager I spoke to said that they have over 100 inspections every year from different bits of the health bureaucracy. And, you know, tens, if not hundreds of different targets. And I think the problem when you have targets on the scale that we have in the NHS is that in the end, patients become numbers. And you lose that link between doctor and patient. If you talk to Andrew Marr about his stroke, he says, well, he had absolutely brilliant hospital care, but it sort of vanished when he went home and needed aftercare, because after he'd had his hospital care that saved his life, that was a tick in the box for the hospital. They got paid for looking after another stroke patient. And then it was someone else's job to do the aftercare, and there wasn't a target. And so I just think we've got to rethink our very target-centric approach.
That linking of things up, that continuity, also covers the huge disconnect between social care and healthcare, which you reference, and also was struck by the fact that the committee you sit on covers both. But yet, out in the real world, they're so disconnected, and that wastes, again, so much time, money. I mean, and there's an example in the book of, you know, lives.
Yeah. It's getting better. We are seeing the health and social care system beginning to be joined up in parts of the country. But I think this is an issue where actually funding really does matter. My select committee, so I negotiated a big rise in the NHS budget. I was not successful in doing so for the social care budget. And so one of the first things I did with my committee was ask how much money the social care system actually needs, because, you know, we've got more and more older people, and you know, it makes no sense at all what we have at the moment, where people get stuck in hospitals because there's no care package in the community. A hospital bed is £300 a night. A care home bed is £100 a night. Sending a carer around once or twice a day is £50 a day. So it's far cheaper to look after people in the community, far nicer. We think that the care system needs about its budget needs to be increased over a 5-year period by about £7 billion a year, which is a big increase, not all in one go, but gradually. The government's basically gone to about £2 billion a year. So there's a gap there in local authority funding and capability. And while that gap is there, it's going to be difficult to integrate the NHS and care systems, because the local NHS, which is also stretched, is going to be worried about the financial liability of getting close to a system that is even more stretched than they are. And I do think you have to think of the two systems as one.
The way in which all of these problems are brought to light, as the book, you know, clearly shows, is by individuals who've become campaigners because they've been through these unimaginable scenarios that you relate. Surely it shouldn't be down to them.
I know. It's they, and I really, I wrote the book because of them, because there's a lady called Melissa Mead who lost her one-year-old baby to sepsis because it wasn't spotted in time. And she has become one of the country's greatest sepsis campaigners. And she came to see me, and she sat opposite me, deeply suspicious of me. She thought, I'm going to be fobbed off by another politician. She plonked William's teddy bear in front of her on the table. And I found out after the meeting that inside that teddy bear were William's ashes. And she was taking these ashes around the media, you know, all her TV interviews. And she's an amazing lady. She is reliving the agony of losing William over and over again to increase awareness of sepsis. So thanks to her, on the sides of ambulances today, you see stickers saying, could it be sepsis, to try and raise awareness. She persuaded me to fund that. And they are so brave. But what you see time and time again, you're right, Hannah, is that we're basically leaning on those people to bang the drum for changes, rather than a system. What we need is a system that is hungry to learn those changes itself. And if you continue, as not just us, it's all over the world, if you continue to punish... I mean, let me put it this way. You and I make mistakes in our work. I'm sure you never do, Hannah, but I occasionally do. And no one dies when I make a mistake in my line of work. I give a lousy speech or do a lousy media interview and I'm embarrassed professionally, but no one dies. But doctors and nurses have very bravely chosen to go into a profession where the price of a mistake could sometimes be a tragedy. And so, you know, I'm not saying that in amongst 1.4 million people there won't be the odd bad apple. Of course there will be. But the vast, vast majority are trying to do the right thing. And when they make those human mistakes, the right response is to listen and support them because they are as devastated as the families that something's gone wrong. And they want to learn from that mistake. And then we can avoid that toxic blame culture. And I'm sorry to apologise to any lawyers here this evening, but one of the issues is that lawyers get involved very quickly as well. And that makes everyone very defensive about speaking openly about what's happened. And the single thing that matters most of all is that the tragedy is not repeated. And that doesn't happen. So that's how a Conservative gets applause, by criticising lawyers. I'm going to remember that for next time.
That's a huge cultural change. Other industries have, as you mentioned, the airline industry perhaps looked at becoming more transparent. But when you write about the NHS, it comes all the way through the book, this notion that the blame culture is deeply embedded. There's fear all the way through. No one really ever wants to own up to anything. So how do you change that?
Well,
why is it so deeply embedded?
Okay, so there's the thing that you can't do from on high, which is you need inspiring leaders in hospitals who are open about their own mistakes and create a learning culture. And we have got some brilliant hospitals in this country. Western Sussex, used to be run until she retired very recently, Dame Marianne Griffiths. It's got the best learning culture, one of the best learning cultures of any hospital anywhere in the world, actually. It's amazing. Salford Royal, run until recently by Sir David Dalton. Again, a fantastic learning culture. So we do have, and they're generally led by those leaders who make people secure and feel able to talk openly about things that are gone wrong. But there are some things that we could change in the law. So if there's a mistake when your child is born and the child ends up with cerebral palsy, in order to get compensation, a court has to agree that there was clinical negligence, either by a doctor or by a hospital. And that can take between 5 and 10 years. Now, every single one of us, if we had a child born with cerebral palsy, would be thinking about that child's future, and we would want the money, rightly. And so a lawyer would say to us, well, tell us what happened, and OK, we'll start the process. No doctor wants to be found guilty of clinical negligence, so they fight it, and it takes 6 or 7 years often to resolve this. Now, that they had that same system in Japan until 2009, and then they changed it, and they said there's going to be automatic compensation for all severe CP cases. And we're just going to concentrate on learning what goes wrong. And in the 11 years since 2009, their CP cases have gone down by 25%. And of course, ultimately, that is costing the state far less than our system because of the blame culture we have. So it's a very, very important thing to change.
You mentioned this in the book, the blame culture is something that people see happening very much when they turn on PMQs or whenever they see politicians, you know, from either side talking particularly about the NHS. It's vitriolic and there's so much blame. So that trickles down.
It does. And I did ask myself the question, you know, if I'm saying we shouldn't have a blame culture in medicine, you know, does the same apply to politics? And I find myself conflicted because the brutality of Prime Minister's questions, it is theatre And sometimes it is, frankly, silly. But it's also part of the way that we remind our politicians that politicians are the servants of the people, not the bosses of the people. It's a very raw accountability. And I think, ultimately, it is a good thing in our country. It keeps our politicians' feet on the ground. But I do think that we need space for people to talk about things they've got wrong. I actually quite surprised at how willing people have been to accept me talking about the things I got wrong as health secretary in my book. I thought there'd be a lot of yaboo after that, and there actually hasn't been. So I think that's a good thing, and I think we should allow more space for that.
But you actually sit down, I think, with your fiercest critic for the book, one of the junior doctors. I wonder what you learnt from your conversation with her, and also, you know, what perhaps does that, when you look back, feel like a moment that you'd rather forget?
I think it's certainly a moment I'd rather forget. It was very, very sad that it happened. And, you know, I often ask myself if I could have avoided it, because if you're trying to improve culture in the NHS and deal with all these issues that we've been talking about, you know, 55,000 junior doctors are a very, very important audience for those messages, and they stopped listening to me. And it took me a very long time to mend fences, and I'm sure that some people still bruise today. So I was very, very sad that it happened. I think that the changes I wanted in the contract were important to improve cover on Saturdays. If I'm honest, it was more important to get more consultants working at the weekends than junior doctors. That would have made the biggest difference. And I wish I'd focused my energy on changing the consultants' contract, not the junior doctor contract. And that remains unchanged to this day. So, you know, I can look at that. But I think the biggest thing that I learned from that was that sometimes, and I'm afraid in a completely different context, you see this in Ukraine, sometimes battle lines can get drawn very, very quickly in a way that makes it impossible for either side to retreat. It's unfortunately, it's very difficult to see a rapid ending to the Ukraine crisis because Ukraine is never going to compromise on losing territory, and Russia's never going to, or going to fight very hard not to give up what they've gained. And in that junior doctor strike, within a matter of weeks, the BMA had balloted for strike action, and I'm afraid to say 98% of junior doctors voted for strike action. But once that happened, it was the BMA leadership couldn't negotiate with me because basically they had such a strong mandate and they felt they had to respect that mandate. And so the die was cast, and it was a... So I, you know, I learned that advice. I said, you know, try... I said to Sajid, actually, when he was health secretary, try and resolve these issues before it goes to a ballot for strike if you possibly can, because things can get very hairy after that.
And he probably listened, because it's the one area that...
Oh, he's not health secretary anymore, so, yeah. You know...
I was actually just thinking, do we have one?
We do, Steve Barclay.
Yes, OK, he's still there.
Yes.
We just better probably check. He might have left while we've been talking. You obviously, in the last few years, have spoken up quite a bit about the pandemic and the way that that's been dealt with. And in the book, you talk about groupthink. And you attribute that groupthink to one of the reasons why we might have got things wrong.
Yes, I mean, I don't think we should... I think we should recognise that the NHS and, in fact, ministers worked very hard on pandemic preparations. We did a huge exercise, a three-day exercise called Exercise Cygnus, involving hundreds of people. And we were rated by Johns Hopkins University in America as the second best prepared country for a pandemic in the world. The best prepared was the United States. Both those countries had very bad first years of COVID. And the reason was because there was groupthink that if we had a pandemic in this country, it would be a flu-like pandemic, because that was the pandemics that we'd had here. And so if you look at the recommendations and if you look at the report from Exercise Cygnus, you can do, you won't find testing mentioned once, not once. And, you know, that is because flu spreads very quickly, so you don't have that long asymptomatic period, which is what is so vicious about COVID, when you can test people and try and get them to isolate. So that was the groupthink. And I think that it also meant that in the early stages of the pandemic, we didn't look hard enough at countries like South Korea and places like Taiwan that had experience of SARS and ramped up their testing right from the outset. We actually stopped our community testing at a very early stage because we were still thinking in this about this flu-like likelihood of the pandemic.
You actually sort of quote Matt Hancock and Dominic Cummings in there as, you know, being having their doubts but not being able to speak up because of this idea of groupthink.
Yes, it's very hard to challenge a very deeply entrenched consensus on how things should be done. And I do recognise that. And I think it's also worth saying that the same people who got that element of our pandemic handling wrong at the outset, although we did then go for test and trace in a big way, but in the outset we got it wrong, at the very same time as they were getting those decisions wrong, were ordering 400 million doses of vaccines that we didn't know if they worked or not. And we ended up with, you know, one of the very best vaccine programs in the world. So that is what is fascinating, how, you know, people can make good decisions and bad decisions at exactly the same time.
I mean, one of the things that the pandemic did was speed up the use of technology, you know, in the NHS. But you write in the book that they're still using faxes. In so many areas of our lives, we everything's so much easier because of tech and the availability to us. But the NHS does seem to still be incredibly slow. And I should add, of course, there is a balance because, as you say, you know, computers and tech can be a barrier between patients and doctors, and many people want to see a doctor face-to-face. But I'm interested in how you get that balance right.
It's really interesting because our hospital tech is often pretty lousy, and it's very frustrating for people who work in hospitals. And our GP tech is amongst the very best in the world. And interestingly, that is because when Blair did Connecting for Health, he tried to get the whole NHS signed up, and the GPs refused to be part of it. They are legally independent entities. They're legally private businesses, actually. And they said, we don't want anything to do with this. And Connecting for Health sort of ended up becoming too huge a project, and it basically ended up collapsing, and that sort of set us back. The GPs, meanwhile, very quietly got on with the business of putting all our health records into a digital format. They did it very, very quietly. There are two or three different systems they use. They were competing against each other. They're very good systems. All GPs use one of these two or three systems. And ironically, if you're going to choose, do you want to have the best hospital tech or the best GP tech in the world, you would choose GPs, because a GP record is what's called a longitudinal record of your whole life. And that actually has what happened in hospital added into it, whereas a hospital record will just be of, you know, one incident, your appendicitis or your hip being replaced or something like that. So that is why people often say that NHS IT system, NHS technology is a goldmine in terms of medical research, because we have very, very good records for 50 million people in a similar format that, you know, and we're the country that first discovered the link between lung cancer and smoking. We've had many extraordinary discoveries, but this has incredible potential. So there is some upside.
I mean, you do talk about some extraordinary developments that you see happening pretty imminently in your conversations with people who work in tech, particularly with being able to do blood samples and find out about diseases long before they've even we've even got symptoms.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, the mantra in health is that prevention is better than cure, and we are not very far away. I wouldn't be surprised if within a decade we are all sending a blood sample to a laboratory once every 6 months, and one blood sample has about 300 biomarkers, and by looking at the changes in those biomarkers from the sample you sent 6 months earlier, or indeed by reference to other people in the population, you might well be able to spot bowel cancer before you have any symptoms at all. And there are some very exciting trials going on. So I think, and you know, the other thing that's happening that's very interesting is the decoding of genomes, where, you know, I think at one point in the pandemic, we were decoding half the genomes in the entire world, half the COVID genomes that were being decoded in the entire world, which is why we became the place for identifying new variants. So I think there's an opportunity for the NHS actually to leapfrog other countries and be the first country where, you know, if we said every baby that's born on the NHS will have a decoded genome sitting on their medical record, and doctors will be able to look at that record and say, not just this is what's happened to you, but these are the areas which you need to watch out for given your genetic profile. Lots of privacy issues to think about in all that, but it's potentially very exciting.
I'm wary. I can see from your watch that my time of question asking is pretty much done. But thank you very, very much for taking the time to come this evening. And thank you.
There are a few signed copies around, and all the profits go to charity. Patient Safety Watch, in fact. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations Live. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. And to learn more about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.